Thank you, Howard, for inviting me. And thanks to you all for just a terrific welcome. And Howard, what a great ministry you have here. My reading is by Roy Phillips. He was a longtime minister of Unity Church in St. Paul, Minnesota. He writes, "Once in a sermon entitled Sleeping in Church, I explained that when I preach, I am trying to put the congregation to sleep. I believe what I have been told, that we dream 24 hours a day. It seems a shame that many of us are tuned to these productions of the deeper mind only when tucked in our beds at night. I try to put the congregation to sleep when I preach so they can dip into that rich experience in church as well. Some members of the congregation, however, are doggedly resistant to my efforts to induce sleep. I try to offer something special for them. Confusion. If I can confound a half dozen or more people during a sermon, I consider it a good day. The reason for this is that by the end of every given week, we tend to have things pretty much figured out about life, the world, our neighbors, our enemies, perhaps even ourselves. We have a clear outlook. Our pathway is neatly charted, and we are on our way, oversimplifying, generalizing, deleting away important aspects of reality so we can have a nice theory. A sermon which confuses is my gift to the congregation. For while systematic formulations and philosophical or scientific abstractions may render life more manageable, manageability takes its toll in lost color, richness, range, and depth of lived experience. If a sermon of mine can lure listeners into confusion, I know I am doing my job. For bafflement is a room which opens into awe." The sea does not reward those who are too anxious, too greedy, or too impatient, writes Anne Morrow Lindbergh. To dig for treasures shows not only impatience and greed, but lack of faith. Patience, patience, patience is what the sea teaches. Patience and faith. One should lie empty, open, choiceless as a beach, waiting for a gift from the sea. My ministry began, get ready for this, 48 years ago this past summer. Yes, I walked 5 miles to school, uphill, both ways. My ministry began 48 years ago this past summer in the National Park campgrounds in the amphitheaters of Acadia, where, as a graduating senior from the University of Maine, I was about to enter the Divinity School at Vanderbilt University in very far off Tennessee. I was part of the National Council of Churches ministry in the national parks, and I had been reassigned in the late spring of 1969 from Yellowstone to nearby Acadia, where I was a one-man show. My readings that summer, as I recall, were all secular, 10 years before I found Unitarian Universalism. I so frequently read from Gift from the Sea by Anne Morrow Lindbergh, which you just heard, along with lots and lots of Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. And we sang Blowing in the Wind and Where Have All the Flowers Gone? "Don't go to theological school," a woman breathlessly implored me after an early morning service. "You'll ruin everything." That's one bookend. And this summer, 6 years after retirement from the active ministry, I was reading Jim Crochelle's One Man's Maine, Essays on a Love Affair, he says, and then listen to this and then go buy his book. He tells us his state of mind as he enters the state of Maine. You slide into the Adirondack chair down by the shore where you get the water in the eye and the ecstasy in the muscles of which Buddha and St. Peter boast. There's that second or two of melting into nature as the luminescent future spans the bay. And I marked that passage for you as I read it this summer. Gift from the Sea, One Man's Maine, maybe bookends of a ministry so far. Retirement is surely a time of reflection, so where does the time go these past 6 years, and what does it all mean? I've reflected on this in these 6 years since I occupied this pulpit. And now Eric, the organist, is closer to me. And now there is a clock on the back wall. And it's surely intended for no one but the preacher. View from the pew, I said when asked for a sermon title. And then over the summer, three different views from the other side of the pulpit emerged. And I've mulled them all over. I waited for the pressure to build to just the right point before finally writing. So here's my first reflection from now sitting down there in the pew. I like clear windows. I like to look outside and daydream. When I preach, wrote my colleague, the late Roy Phillips, I try to put the congregation to sleep. And when you saw that, you were thinking literally. Roy said he meant by sleep the dreams we have that leave us confounded. If I can confound a half dozen people or more during a sermon, Roy says, I consider it a good day. I grew up in a church with stained glass windows, and I can remember in my childhood counting the light bulbs in the chandeliers. I counted the small panes of colored glass in the window. I watched our next door neighbor right in the pew in front of us sleep, and sometimes, to my delight, snore loud enough to wake himself up. So I've sought out clear glass ever since. Liz and I remember the beautiful sanctuary of First Unitarian Church in Providence when I worked for the UUA and found myself mostly free on a Sunday. To the left of the pulpit in Providence was a very tall, clear glass window, and it framed the most beautiful magnolia tree that we watched through all the seasons. I dreamed there plenty. And here in Concord, the windows are on two levels. From pulpit and pew, we watch the light and we watch the shadows. And you know, at times in the year, the light is just so, and there's a sky glass there, and the light at times in the year shines right on the preacher. And that's when I tried to say very important things. And here I chase the well-meaning ushers who rush to close the upstairs window shades to protect the parishioners down here from the sunlight. Keep the window shades open, was one sermon from those days. At Fallen Community Church in East Lexington, where Liz and I now worship, we sit in an octagonally shaped room with windows all around, and we watch the snow fall and the leaves change, and the thunderstorms come. I like clear windows. I feel less hemmed in. I can dream. I like the view. The second view from the pew is more mystical. I love the music I hear in church. I loved it from the pulpit, and now I love it in the pew. And some in the First Parish Choir will remember that I sat here in the middle of the sanctuary in the hour before worship and listened to all of you rehearse, as I felt so blessed to do this morning, and let the music just wash over me. Let the voices and the notes feed my soul. I've been confounded by the choir in East Lexington, who always seem to be just finishing their rehearsal when we get there, no matter how early we arrive. On the November Sunday following the presidential election, that sanctuary was full, as I'm sure it was here. Sitting right in front of us was a couple with a college-aged daughter sitting between them. We sang some familiar closing hymn. Could it have been "How Can We Keep From Singing?" And they, the three of them, put their arms around one another and held on tight and sang loudly. I said to them as we were leaving that my witness to their embrace was the most powerful moment of the morning. "That's why I came home," their daughter said to me. One of the greatest moments of President Obama's presidency took place in Charleston, South Carolina, not that long ago, when in the midst of his eulogy for the slain pastor there, Obama just began to sing. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." And you can see the faces of the pastors behind him in the pulpit. They look surprised, and they begin to light up, and they stand up, and they surround him, and they clap, and they sing, and music did what words could not. They lifted a people. Music is an equalizer, be it instrumental, vocal, chanting, because we come to the same level. Two of my grandchildren are in musical theater, and I watch what happens when a benevolent director gives parts to the many and not to the few. Children are empowered. They're transformed. They learn how to walk. There is a vulnerability that takes place when you sing and I sing, a lowering of the barriers that keep us apart. And that's why it was a teeny bit disheartening to look from here and see some of you there resolutely not sing the hymns. You deprive the community of your voice, tone rich or tone deaf, on key or off. It's the making of the music that matters. So from my view now in the pew, I sing. And almost always when you sing and you perform, I am moved. And when children sing, I swallow hard. That's two views from the pew if you're counting. I need clear windows, and I love beautiful music. And now the third view begins with a confession, as in, you were right and I was wrong. Liz and I sit in the same pew Sunday after Sunday. That's my third view. I like sitting in the same pew. And I used to make fun of you for this. I knew where you sat, most of you. I took attendance from that chair. And I knew where all the friendly and expressive faces were when I preached. And you knew this. Some of you will remember that when I returned from a sabbatical leave once, you had conspired and you sat in entirely different places on my first Sunday back. And you thought you were so funny because I looked more and more puzzled as the hour passed. Why are they sitting up there? And then I got it. There are psychological and sociological studies that indicate we tend to head for a certain part of the room for any event where there are rows and there is a stage. It's a comfort zone, safe place. But it has been in retirement that I realized something else. I woke up to something when I was sitting there in Lexington, not here. We sit in the same pew, and I told you we're often the first ones there. Those who come after us and sit near us adjust where they're sitting to where we are. Sometimes it's one pew up, sometimes it's one pew farther back, but we know who sits to our left and who sits to our right, who sits just behind us and in front of us. Lillian Anderson at Jean Brown's memorial service a few weeks ago said something like that. She said, "Jean sat right across the aisle from me for years, and I'll miss him." And at Fallen last winter on one Sunday during the sharing of joys and concerns, we learned that the woman who always sat at the end of the pew, always there at the end of the pew, had lost her caretaker, her adult daughter. She had died suddenly. And so that mother was in church that Sunday, our neighbor there, and she was swarmed with hugs and touches. But wait, the woman just to our right announced that her daughter, the young woman who sings in the choir, had given birth last night to a baby. And this neighbor was a grandmother for the first time. And that one pew held all of it, as the pews here hold it all. We sit where we do so we can have a more intimate community within the larger community, because we want to be missed. We want to be held. And do not make this view I have of community as an excuse, forgive me, for building a wall around us. I have watched the dear souls in the same pew slide down, move over, move up for any guest or lost soul. The election, two women said last November, "We had to come. We've never been to church before." "Welcome," we said. "We're so glad you came." View from the pew. I realize again how much I like clear windows, because what is often happening is too big for one room. View from the pew. I have had reaffirmed again and again how much music moves me, my favorite hymns, all these anthems I've heard here at First Parish, the voices of the By Your Side singers who joined the voices of my oldest brother and sister-in-law in Chelmsford for a time, the children who sing here and who sing in Lexington, the songs on the bus in Transylvania, "The Storm Is Passing Over," all of it. Music and worship holds it all together. Well, it holds me all together. It helps hold the world together sometimes. View from the pew. If you're lucky like me, there are small pockets of community all over the room. People who will miss you when you're not here. People who will laugh with you. People who will cry with you, cheer with you, despair with you, hold you, go forth with you. Our dear Catholic neighbors across the street call it passing the peace. Central to their mass, so it is for us. Perhaps this is the most important thing for me to take back from beach living, writes Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Simply the memory that each cycle of the tide is valid. Each cycle of the wave is valid. Each cycle of a relationship is valid. And may this be true for you and for me in the years ahead. Minister Emeritus, each cycle of the tide, each cycle of the wave, each cycle of a relationship.